From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
There was a struggle between Vanessa and her assailant that led to scratches, cuts, scrapes, and or bruises.
The investigation continues into the murder of a young woman in Princeton, Mass. We'll talk about that and more in our Week in Review. Also today, you're done with your beach books, so what now?
Summer is a great time for fast-paced books, but it's also a great time for sort of deep dive kinds of books.
We've got a great summer nonfiction reading list for you. And Shira Springer has some choice words for how NBC is covering the Olympics. None of them are pretty.
It's mind-blowing, it's boggling, it's shameful. I mean, there are plenty of words.
Shira's in Rio, and she's got some great Olympics moments you're not seeing on TV. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Friday, which means it's time for the Week in Review. And let's start with the controversy over Boston police and the weapons they carry. Community leaders called it racist and overly aggressive. They were talking about a letter sent by the heads of three Boston police unions demanding better armor and more powerful weaponry, including semi-automatic rifles and shotguns. Supporters of the police, like retired Boston Police Superintendent Daniel Linsky, say the weapons are essential in an era where police are called upon to respond to and are often the targets of terrorism.
The rank and file of the police department has been feeling the need to be better equipped to respond to these situations. And it's not to be deployed until needed. And it's not to be deployed haphazardly.
However, community leaders such as Michael Curry at the Boston NAACP say those weapons could be misused.
You give more tools to law enforcement, where you'll see them most is in communities of color. So you'll end up seeing in situations that would have been handled differently, you will start seeing law enforcement come in with long guns.
Well, we'll talk about this and the week's other news today with Renee Graham. She's a contributor to WBUR and the Boston Globe as well. Renee, good to see you again. Also today with us in the studio is Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Good to see you, Jim.
Good to see you, too.
All right, so let's talk about this letter. It was an undated letter that was made public last week, and we had a lot of reaction from various members of the community in Boston this week. I mean, I think, obviously, many people were quite taken aback. I mean, that's a word that the mayor himself used about the tone that this letter from the three police unions had. I mean, for example, there's a line, a statement in the letter saying, quote, "We live in a world where a sitting president has basically fanned the flames of police hatred, and you can sing Kumbaya and we shall overcome until the cows come home, but that won't stop a rifle round aimed at a police officer's chest." So that was embedded in this larger call for more advanced weaponry. Renee, your take.
You know, I thought the letter was really interesting. People keep saying that it's sharply worded, and I think that's a harsh understatement. You know, this is the kind of letter that you don't read. This is the kind of letter that, in the vernacular of the fierce, reads you. It called out the mayor. It called out President Obama for, quote-unquote, fanning the flames of police hatred, which, oh, by the way, he never did. So, I mean, obviously the police are reacting very strongly to some of the things that have happened this summer, the assassinations of officers in Dallas and in Baton Rouge, but this militarization of the police department does not help communities. It creates more tension between the police and the people they serve. And, you know, I'm not sure that the police officers are taking that into account.
Hmm. Jim?
So it's aggressive. Its level of capitalization, exclamation, all the rest is way over the top. The big takeaway for me is the need for discipline in the ranks. This is a completely undisciplined letter. And you think about the police report to the people through the office of the mayor here in Boston, just as the military reports to the president, right? And this is way out of line on many fronts. I would say there are some things that real concerns and real frustrations I get. That said, What came off the page to me was a need for training, because the level of emotion, even from leaders in the police here, that go well beyond reason, just to me screams that they actually need to look at training top to bottom.
Uh-huh.
The fact is, we in Boston and around the country do not train our police anywhere like what happens in a European country, which is usually at least two times as long, does not focus on arms, does not focus on fear of the populace that you're actually policing. It focuses on de-escalation, many other strategies, and I think we really need to take a look at how we're training our folks, because I think a lot of them really do go into the policing business with unmitigated fear, which to a great degree is irrational.
So this is one thing that I wondered, that it raised a question in my mind about the letter. And you're right, there's a great degree of, a huge degree of emotion in the letter, which is problematic for a lot of reasons, which we'll discuss. All that emotion also overshadows what many people were pointing at as legitimate requests that these union leaders were making. But the thing that I kept coming back to, Renee, and I'm wondering what you think about this, is that as Jim's saying, like, okay, if that emotion is playing out on the page, it's the same emotion, the same sort of stir of emotion that we may be seeing on the beat, on the streets, in terms of how law enforcement, you know, at times interacts with members of the community.
It keeps ramping it up within the communities. And something, you know, Jim makes a very good point. You know, in all the things that are said in this letter, and it's a rather long letter, they never talk about training. We need to be better trained to handle different situations. All they're really asking for is body armor and long guns and the ability to use them. And we've come to you time and time again to do this. I think that becomes a problem. And I think when the community sees this, and just to read a brief part, it says, "Our officers' lives are more important than worries of offending the people that we are sworn to protect because we may appear militaristic to a very few." That's an antagonistic statement. So it's sort of dismissing the community's concerns that police departments are rolling in onto their streets, you know, like the military. And they're sort of dismissing it and saying, well, that's not important. What's important is our lives. What's important is the lives of the officers and the lives of the people they are supposed to protect and serve.
Well, Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans was one of the people to whom this letter was sent originally. And here's some of his thoughts that he shared with WBZ this week.
Everybody sometimes feels underappreciated and under attack. And so I think he's speaking from the heart. But, you know, I wish some of the words he didn't use are a little offensive. But, you know, I think it's a hard time to be a police officer now, so I know where he's coming from.
Okay, so Commissioner Evans there, kind of taking a very balanced approach in his reaction. But one thing that I did notice in the letter is the union presidents kind of frequently said, two or three times at least, that they felt that they weren't being heard. I mean, they're currently in contract negotiations, and they were saying that that they felt that they weren't being heard, and this letter was an attempt to sort of break through that and get heard by the mayor, by Commissioner Evans. You know, could that be part of the reason why there was so much emotion here? Maybe police officers don't feel they've been heard as much as maybe community members.
It's unprofessional. If you have the ability to use force on people at all times, your professionalism must reign supreme. And it is unprofessional and, frankly, works against them. Let's assume for a second that heavy heavy power armaments are needed in specific situations with specific approvals and specific oversight by the police and the community. All right, let's assume that, which is one of the arguments they're making. And I actually think there's some truth to that. There's no way to sell that in the community if you don't have trust, unless you actually have de-escalation strategies that show that you are seeking to build trust. At that point, you can have the conversation with folks. If they feel like they're not being heard, it's because they're screaming. They need to actually step back, de-escalate, focus on that. And then later on, they can actually come in and say, we need some other tools. And people would understand that, I think.
Mm. Well, Renee, I was just going to say that Daniel Linsky, former Superintendent Daniel Linsky, just yesterday sat right here at this table and said, look, he was there at the Marathon bombing and then the Watertown shootout thereafter. And he felt like, you know, Boston police themselves didn't feel like they were equipped in the way that surrounding law enforcement from surrounding communities were equipped. And he said, you know, honestly, that's the kind of thing that we're thinking of when we say maybe more officers should have this heavier firepower, the semi-automatic weapons.
And he does make a good point. However, I don't think that this letter is in reaction to what happened 3 years ago. This letter is in reaction to what happened last month in Dallas and Baton Rouge, and just the idea that police feel that they are not being supported by their communities, and more so not being supported by the politicians around them. That's what this is about to me. So, yes, fine, they may have felt like they were outgunned and outmanned during the marathon situation, but I don't think this has anything to do with that. This is, you know, we feel like we're under siege and we want to feel like we can handle the situation. And they're not taking into consideration how this feels in these communities. We saw what happened in Ferguson. We saw what happened in Baltimore. It didn't de-escalate anything. All it did was get people more and more agitated. Mm-hmm. So you know, I can respect what he's saying on one hand, but I don't think that's the full truth.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot more to discuss about this letter and its ramifications, if any, as time goes by. So I want to put that aside for a moment, if we could, and just move on to another of the week's major stories, and that is the fact that both presidential nominees were in Michigan this week. They were laying out their plans to boost the U.S. economy.
Only by changing to new leadership and new solutions will we get new and great results. We need to stop believing in politicians and start believing in our great country.
So here's what I want. I want every American family to be able to tell the same story. If you work hard, you do your part, you should be able to give your children all the opportunities they deserve. That is the basic bargain of America.
So that, of course, was Donald Trump in Detroit on Monday and Hillary Clinton in Warren, Michigan, just yesterday. Jim, let's start with you. I personally found both speeches sort of long on rhetoric and short on detail.
Okay. So
I should phrase that in the form of a question. Do you agree?
Look, Donald Trump gave us a written script that was very much orthodoxy from the Republican Party. And, you know, much of that I actually would agree with. I mean, the fact that if you unleash the economy by having the government take a smaller role and have people have access to more of their own money to invest as they will, we will do better. I personally believe that the Brookings Institution is wrong on that. They say it won't. One of the missing things here, though, is there's not really a belief in free trade. I mean, in his speech, he's also talking about how the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is not something we should go forward with because, you know, we're getting screwed by everybody. He also has no plan on Medicare and nothing on Social Security. So as you reduce taxes, what's your response on the expense side to make sure that you don't make America's debt great again, mm-hmm. right? So it's there's not much more beyond some basic tax cut stuff that's in there. On the Clinton side, look, this is status quo stuff. There's not really much change here. There's some infrastructure investment I'm not even sure it could get through. It's been pushed before. The broadband stuff is small potatoes. There's actually a tax increase for small business owners and small business investors. I'm not sure that's going to grow the economy. So if I was a middle-class person listening to it, I would say, I don't know which one is actually speaking to me.
Interesting. Renee?
You know, the thing that always sticks out for me in these speeches, I mean, look, we're in the rhetoric season. You know, this is the time where you can promise everything because you don't have to deliver right now. So I think there was a lot of that in both speeches. Something that constantly comes through with Donald Trump is this notion that we're going to bring jobs back. You know, and this is coming from a man who has a lot of his own products made overseas and says he does so because it's good for business. So how is he the person to say that we're going to be able to bring these jobs back and, you know, we're going to do this for America and we're going to get those jobs from China? That's not really going to happen. That's unrealistic. The one thing I do appreciate in what Hillary Clinton says is that we're not going to bring those jobs back, but we're going to figure out a way to innovate and do things here. Those jobs that we've lost in manufacturing aren't coming back. You know, at least it feels like it's an adult approach and it's not patronizing. Hmm. And so telling people something that really can't happen.
Well, we'll talk about Clinton more in just a second. But one of several points that did stick out to me in Donald Trump's speech, and Jim, you actually alluded to this. There was a moment, I believe, where he said that isolation isn't the answer, to take your words, Jim, that was definitely a page out of the standard Republican playbook. And he hadn't actually said that in so clear terms before. So I sort of walked away from the speech thinking that the Republican establishment did elbow its way into what he said. Now, does it mean that he actually means it, or that would later on, you know, should he win the White House, actually become his economic plan? I don't know. But did that mark something of a change in tone or perception or take?
Not to me. I think in terms of repatriating money that's abroad, profits to about $2 trillion, yes. He doesn't want to isolate himself from that, but he has not changed one iota on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The sad thing for me is that both candidates have turned their backs on free trade, which have been enormously helpful to people around the world and, frankly, to this country as well. I understand the kind of disruptions it's led to, and, frankly, we should focus there. But I don't think he's changed whatsoever there. In fact, his advisors all of whom I believe, if I can think of three of them, the main ones, were complete free marketeers and have actually turned their backs on free market approaches, that is, trade with the Pacific.
Mm. And Renee, so do you hear sort of a same Republican orthodoxy, or that's less Trumpism and more GOPism in his speech?
Well, look, I think given all the situations that happened with him last week, he was very much about sort of parroting these Republican economic talking points, you know, right off the teleprompter. I don't really believe that's where Donald Trump stands at all. You know, I think he's saying these things that the Republican Party wants him to say in that moment. But once he goes off script, it becomes something else entirely. So I'm not really sure that even as much as he said it and, you know, however much conviction he put into it, I don't really think that's what's going to occur if he becomes president.
Hmm. And talk to me more about what Jim was saying earlier, that, you know, whether it's Trump or Clinton, he couldn't. I thought you made a good point, Jim, that, you know, in terms of working people in America, Jim didn't feel like either candidate or nominee now really sort of presented a plan that would specifically say, like, here is actually how I'm going to help you.
Well, no one ever does at this point. You know, it's just about making people feel good. Like, I want to say the right thing to get you to vote for me in November. But, you know, when push comes to shove, these things never help the working class. They never help the middle class. You know, they always somehow help the people at the top. So, you know, I think that, you know, Clinton can put a shinier veneer on it all, but I think it sort of comes down to the same when you have to give concrete answers to people on how you're going to make their lives better, how they're going to feel more secure economically. And I don't really think I didn't come away with that feeling from either speech.
Mm. Jim, was there anything that you would have wanted to hear from either Trump or Clinton this week regarding the economy that you didn't and think they should be talking about more?
Yeah, there are quite a few things. Look, on the infrastructure side, I think there's a lot that could have been said. And to her credit, Clinton did talk about infrastructure, about a $275 billion investment. The problem is that she's thinking about in the same old way through raising taxes as well. And there's a lot that could be done to make that program so much more effective, even without raising significantly more dollars. So if, one example, Massachusetts is an old state. A lot of our states have old infrastructure, and when we want to go after federal funds, we usually can only get access to federal funds at sort of an 80-20 split, sometimes a 50-50 split with the feds, if it's for new infrastructure. And sometimes places need to actually rebuild what they have, right? So there are things that just being creative with what we have could actually achieve so much more. So, yeah. I mean, there are many things like that, though.
Okay. Well, obviously, the economy is also something that we'll return to again and again. And I take your point, Renee, that this isn't a time necessarily that we expect specifics from...
We'd like them.
We'd like them, exactly, from the nominees. And hopefully, maybe we'll get some in the coming weeks. Well, I do want to spend a couple minutes talking about the really awful murder of 27-year-old Vanessa Marcotte. She went for a jog on Sunday afternoon in Princeton, Mass. Her body was found in the woods just a half mile away from her mother's home in the evening. And police have received hundreds of tips. They opened an anonymous tip line. Here's Worcester DA Joe Early yesterday and what he had to say.
Evidence and information that we have in this case, again, leads us to believe that there was a struggle between Vanessa and her assailant that led to scratches, cuts, scrapes, and or bruises.
DA Early wouldn't specify what that evidence is, but he said that police don't know whether her murder was a random act. So really a horrible story, and in part because Princeton hasn't seen anything like this in 30 years. And so there's a lot of concern now around safety in these smaller towns. Jim, your thought?
Well, if he knows that... the assailant had scratches and cuts and scrapes. It's obviously underneath her nails. It tells you something about the level of struggle. So first thing is deep sorrow for the family. You know, these are one of these topics you don't know how to talk to people, how you actually approach this, because it affects people in terms of how they actually think about their everyday life. Renee and I were talking about this a little bit earlier. You know, do you have to change your schedule all of a sudden now? Do you have to run with a partner now? The only thing I'd say, and this is, I'm useless on topics like these, okay?
So, fair enough.
But the only thing I'd say is the fact that the Globe was reporting that there were a couple other people in, I think it was Northborough and another one in Westborough, who had, there may have been some sort of connection. I would just think that as many tips as possible is what has to happen right now so they can find this person.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry for being useless.
No, it's not. I mean, I think it just it goes to the fact that these things are never easy to talk about, and yet, you know, they do happen. And so, Renee, your thoughts?
You know, when I heard about it, my first thought was, as a woman, you're never safe. She was in a community, I assume she knew well, her mother lived there, in an area where she'd probably jogged before. It was early afternoon.
Yeah.
It was well-traveled, and someone still got her. You know, a lot has been made, you know, with everything with unarmed, you know, black people getting shot by the police, about the talk that parents have, especially with their black sons, about how to conduct themselves with the police. And don't think that there isn't a talk that also occurs between parents and their daughters in how to protect themselves. You know, walk in well-lit areas. Don't walk by yourself. Make sure you have your phone with you. All of that. I have a cell phone because my father insisted I get a cell phone years ago because I was traveling a lot. He's like, you need to have a cell phone in case something happens. And you can do everything right and it still might not protect you. And that's the feeling I had, is that you're just never safe. You can change your route. You can be with friends. You can do all these things. And, you know, familiarity isn't security.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can go in the area you know well and it still might not protect you. And I think that's what I found most, I mean, other than, you know, the loss of this really wonderful young woman, but I found that really depressing.
Yeah.
That you have to constantly be looking over your shoulders and you hear women saying, oh, I don't wear my headphones on anymore, and I don't run alone, or I don't run at dusk, and I don't do this. You have to alter your entire life just to live.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ridiculous. It's just, it's absolutely absurd. And I don't think people ever consider how sort of psychologically damaging that can be until something like this happens.
Yeah. I think that's very, very well put. And I actually can't think of much to add to that. So let's all take a deep breath here, because I am going to shift gears, because I do want to end on a little bit of an up note. Let's take a second to shift gears and say that we will end on our hubbubs, and that is the lighter story that maybe we didn't cover this week, because again, I think it's worth just celebrating a little bit of the joy of life as well, even as we cover very heavy things usually in the Week in Review segment. So, Jim, I'm going to ask you. It's been a tough Week in Review for you today.
Get that pivot going, Jim.
I'm trying to stretch the time so that at least it's not like so close to talking about what happened in Princeton. But would you like to give our first hubbub?
Yeah, sure. So, my hubbub is a peon to free market entrepreneurship. How's that?
That's good.
So for weeks now, Victoria's Diner has seen its business tank on weekends because of Friday and Saturday night drag racing. But while some are scared off by the aggressive racers, the entrepreneur sees in this great opportunity. Universal Hub notes this. Sue Sullivan of the Newmarket Square Business Association said a hot dog vendor who normally only plies the streets during the day has started setting up shop on Friday and Saturday nights to feed hungry drag racers who sometimes assemble in the South Bay parking lot, and their fans who gather in parking lots of other businesses in the area. If you relish a red hot Frankfurter on Mass Ave tonight, however, you might have to catch up with this vendor during the day. The police captain has promised to have officers on the scene to break up any racing and hot dogging.
Jim, you get my award for the pun that put a smile on my face today.
I'm a real trooper.
We needed that pun.
We did need those puns. Okay. Renee, your hubbub.
For those of you who think of former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown as a pickup truck kind of guy, this week it was all about his bike.
Mm.
He was flying to Omaha for a triathlon, and somehow the airline lost his bike. And he went to Twitter, of course, to tweet his discontent. You know, he wanted his bike, he needed his bike. How could this happen? Anyway, his bike was located and returned to him in pieces because the airline has to take the bike apart to have it fit into a certain area. This did not make him terribly happy, but hopefully, you know, the bike and the triathlon will be salvageable, unlike some of the other endeavors that Scott Brown is supposed to be endorsing and supporting.
Okay. Well, my hubbub has to do with President Obama and this following tweet. Quote, been waiting to drop this. Summer playlist, the encore. What's everybody listening to? I will put money down now and say I don't think that the president really speaks in those terms. It wasn't even signed -BO, so we know he didn't actually write that tweet. But his summer playlist, because he's on vacation, you know, right here in our neck of the woods. Interesting, the daytime playlist, he's got some good stuff. Tightrope from Janelle Monáe. I'm seeing Aretha Franklin here, Nina Simone. He's even got some Jay-Z. Many of the Miles, interesting. Maybe that was one of his daughters asked him to put that on there. Okay, so then in the nighttime playlist, it's pretty good. He's got Aaron Neville, who else? Method Man, Chance the Rapper, Miles Davis. But we wanted to go out on a local connection here because number two on his on the president's nighttime playlist, Esperanza Spalding. Grammy Award-winning bass player, musician, and teacher, you know, world-famous jazz artist, 2005 graduate from Berklee College of Music. So here's Esperanza Spalding to help us ease into the weekend. And that's the end of my hubbub. Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute, you are a true trooper. Thank you so much for coming in
it's
today.
It's nice to be with you.
And Renee Graham, contributor to WBR and the Boston Globe, thank you as well.
Thank you.
We'll be back. This is Radio Boston.
I almost believe. Almost believe all the sorrows will consume me. To peace among men I never can see. But I'm not
sure. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
10 seconds from a gold medal.
Well, that was the call yesterday in Rio when Kayla Harrison of Marblehead won gold in women's judo. It was a historic win for Harrison, and there were other history-making moments as well yesterday, too. So let's check in with Shira Springer, Olympics columnist for the Boston Globe. She's in Rio. And Shira, a great win for Kayla Harrison, wasn't it?
Well, she said it herself. She was a woman on a mission. And she said in her press conference afterwards that she had worked too hard, pushed through too much adversity, which included a reconstructive knee surgery and a separated shoulder, to not win gold. She becomes the first female judoka outside of Asia to win two consecutive Olympic gold medals, and really cemented her legacy as one of the best judokas of all time.
Well, let's move over to gymnastics because we do have to give a well-deserved round of applause to Needham's own Ali Raisman. She took silver in the women's all-around. But of course, really one of the big stories from the Olympics are the two Simones. One of them, Simone Biles, who took gold in the women's all-around. Tell us about her victory.
I think I've been using this word a lot when describing U.S. women's gymnastics, and Simone Biles in particular, dominant. Her final score was all-around score was a 62.198. That was more than 2 points better than Ali Raisman. And that's in a sport where fractions of a point can decide the winner. So I think it's fair to say it was more of a coronation than a competition. No disrespect to anyone else in the field, but that's certainly what it felt like. She is just so far and above the rest of her competitors.
Yeah. So she's the first of the Simones that the world is talking about. The second, of course, is Simone Manuel, the first African-American woman to win an individual swimming medal. She tied for gold in a really, really close 100-meter freestyle final. What a moment there.
And it was a fantastic moment, and she really accepted her role as role model. She hopes that her performance, her gold medal, inspires other Black swimmers to take up the sport and to pursue the sport up to the higher levels. And I think that's an important message because it is a sport where you don't see a lot of Black participants. On the other hand, she also says that she hopes one day there will be a time when she's not referred to as the Black champion, but just an Olympic champion.
Mm. Well, the trailblazing nature of her accomplishment was recognized around the world, except a lot of people reserved quite a bit of criticism for how Simone Manuel's gold medal ceremony was not covered here in the United States by NBC. I mean, they decided to actually not play her gold medal ceremony live and played it an hour later. And instead, while most of the rest of the world was watching Simone get her gold medal and hear the U.S. national anthem, NBC decided to play seven-hour-old gymnastics instead. I mean, what could possibly have spurred NBC to ignore this history-making moment?
I have no idea what could have made them think that that was a wise coverage decision. From what I've heard from people back home, they followed Michael Phelps all around after he won his gold medal last night, devoting minutes of coverage to just tailing him around the pool area, in the pool deck, in the ready room, etc., etc. And you can't spare a couple minutes to watch, you know, the first African-American swimmer take a gold medal.
So sure, that makes me wonder, I mean, maybe this is just the answer is obvious, but how different is it, the experience of the Olympics on the ground in Rio versus what's packaged and delivered to American television audiences?
I think it's like night and day. You don't just see American athletes competing and winning and see U.S., the Star-Spangled Banner being played at medal ceremonies. You also see smaller moments and moments from foreign countries. When I was at fencing, I got to watch a woman win a bronze medal. She was from Tunisia, and I believe she was the first woman from an African nation to win an Olympic medal. And she took that moment to sort of say, hey, this is for all the women out there, for all the Arab women out there. You do deserve a place in society. And that was pretty meaningful. And I don't think that got any coverage on television.
Well, since you did mention fencing, we should also say that Daryl Homer, the U.S. fencer who kindly gave you that saber lesson that we talked about a little earlier this week, he took silver in the men's saber final on Wednesday night. So bravo, Daryl.
Yeah, I know. Do I get some credit for that?
No.
It was pretty cool to be in the stands watching Daryl fence and win silver. He hasn't had the easiest season. He's been a bit up and down, but he is a fencer who comes out for the big competitions and does well. He was incredibly proud, and it was just a nice moment and, you know, a historic moment in its own way. So a lot of history being made by U.S. Olympians.
Well, Shira Springer is the Olympics columnist for the Boston Globe and our woman on the ground in Rio. Hey, have a great weekend. Watch a lot of stuff for us, and we'll talk to you on Monday again, Shira.
Yeah, you got some big locals coming up, by the way. You've got Jevi Stone in the women's single, and then you've got Marblehead's Shalane Flanagan going for a medal in the women's marathon on Sunday. So some events to look forward to. Hopefully NBC will cover them.
Oh, hopefully. We'll check in with you regardless on Monday. Thanks, Shira.
Sounds good.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A couple of weeks ago, we had a conversation about great novels for the summer, those perfect beach book reads that transport you as far as a fiction writer's imagination can go. But truth is, of course, stranger and often more wild and whimsical than fiction. So even though we're kind of in the home stretch for summer, let's talk about some great nonfiction books you might want to pick up before the end of the season. And joining us now to help us with the nonfiction summer read list is Shuchi Saraswat and Eason Kim. Shuchi is a book buyer at the Brookline Booksmith. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And Eason is a creative writing instructor and youth programs fellow at Grub Street in Boston. Eason, welcome. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And sorry, but I'm stumbling all over the place. You can tell it's Friday when my ability to actually speak, a key part of my job, starts falling away. Listeners, by the way, send me a tweet right now at Radio Boston if you're listening and you've got a favorite nonfiction book that you've been reading this summer. Tweet us the name of the book and the author and why you love it. Again, send the tweet to at Radio Boston. Would love to hear from you. Okay, so before we get into Shuchi and Eason, into your lists, into some of your suggestions, just tell me, like, what do you think makes for a great summer nonfiction read? Shuchi?
For me, I love being outside in the summer. And so a lot of the books that I'm drawn to are travel narratives, nature books, and books often that I can pick up and put down that kind of, you know, call me back to them. So I'll often read essay collections this time of year or, you know, books that are kind of looking into one really specific topic in depth that I can just kind of read a chapter and come back to it later.
Yeah, no, that sounds good because, I mean, the summer, unless you've got, you know, 2 weeks and you're on vacation, you can just sit down and read an entire, you know, weighty tome. I like the idea of kind of dipping in and out as time allows. Ison, what about you?
I'm a little bit of the opposite. I actually, when I define a beach read, it's something that maybe day to day during the year, not on vacation, I didn't have time to dive into completely. I love reading books cover to cover, you know, maybe in 6-hour sprints and things like that, but I rarely get that time. And so I usually pick these books that I want to be completely immersed in. I just want to be in that world. And I want to wrap it around me and not put it down and take it with me everywhere when I'm eating and, you know, on the beach everywhere. And those are usually the types of books that I pick.
So I'm going to presume that this distinction doesn't exist for either of you because you are so constantly immersed in the world of books. But why do you think that so many people, when they think about summer reads, quote unquote summer reads or beach books, they first think of, you know, the crime fiction or the novel. And they don't think of all the great nonfiction that's out there.
That's a really good question. I think nonfiction sometimes gets a bad rap because of school. And I think people forget that there's so much out there, even the word essay. You know, I tell folks in a personal essay class and they kind of cringe and they don't even know that they're doing it because they only see essays as academic endeavors.
Yeah.
But obviously we know that essays are just completely broad, open things. And you mentioned, Suchi, the essay collections coming out, many of which are phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And I think, although, once they're turned on to one really good nonfiction book, which I like to do, my husband jokes with me about that. I always have one ready. Once they're turned on to it and they see the open world, at the end of a class that I teach at Grub Street, they often say, wow, I had no idea that there was this much out there.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just being turned on to it.
Yeah, and I think sometimes fiction is an escape, you know, and so people want to be taken to a different world and they don't realize that there are so many ways to escape within nonfiction, you know. One of the books I have in here is this guy who's obsessed with bugs, and it's so, and he's in Sweden, and he's just this entomologist who's talking about the world of bugs, and that is a whole other kind of world within our world that you can escape to. So it doesn't always have to be topical related to news. It doesn't have to be history. There are lots of different ways to kind of escape within nonfiction.
Tell us, I was going to actually ask you, tell us the name of this book about the scientist.
Yeah, that one is The Fly Trap.
The Fly Trap,
yeah,
that was it.
Yeah, by Frederick Schoberg. Yeah, that is really, it's a very slim book. It's very whimsical. And it's a memoir kind of wrapped in about this obsession with bugs.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've actually got some suggestions right here from our listeners coming in over Twitter. Mem Somerville tweets, I loved Lab Girl by Hope Jaron. I think that falls in the memoir category, does it? I don't remember.
I believe so.
Yeah. And Amy Holden Jones sent us a tweet about Ghetto Side, and Peter Butler is rereading A Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson,
a great read to
prepare for a fall hike. So listeners, send us your tweets at Radio Boston about your favorite summer nonfiction reads. We just got three of them from listeners. Tell us the name of the book, the author, if you could, and why you love it. Now, both of you talked about getting outdoors through nonfiction, exploring some of the outdoors and nature. And Shuchi, you had mentioned The Fly Trap. Ison, you've got another sort of nature based one on your list.
I do. This one's a favorite of mine. It's The Soul of an Octopus by Cy Montgomery. And you know, if you think of our dog loving culture here in Boston, you would never think that an octopus would be this cuddly creature with such full personalities. And there's a second reason why I really love this piece is that it sneaks in two stories. So it gives you a behind the scenes of the New England Aquarium, which is a place that I love and I often write there. But it also is a friendship story, and not just between animal and human, but among the humans who care for these animals. And you gain a really whole new level of respect for the staff around the New England Aquarium and how deeply they get engaged with these creatures.
Right. I think Cy Montgomery is such a master at doing that. She folds in these two stories, which help you fall in love with nature and the people who are working to preserve it as well.
I mean, Absolutely.
We talked to her about a separate book about great white sharks, her new book, and it was just fantastic. She did exactly the same thing, especially for a species which is so maligned. mind by humanity, usually. So, Suchi, you've got another one about birds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald. Yeah, I actually read this book last year while camping, and it was the perfect book to read. Helen MacDonald is an incredible writer just at the sentence level. And it's also kind of a really bizarre thing that she decides to do. You know, she's dealing with the death of her father. She's in this moment of very intense grief. So she decides to take on a ghost hawk and train it. And so it's this intense relationship that she has with this very wild, untrainable bird. And at the same time, she's also reading the memoirs of a writer who has been dealing with the same, tried to train a ghost hawk many years ago and failed. And so she's kind of merging his world with hers and just, you know, the way she talks about the bird and the bird's eyes. I mean, it's really a unique book.
Yeah.
And it is actually very absorbing, oddly enough.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I feel like, you know, linking back to what you guys were talking about earlier, these are several great examples about how Not that fiction doesn't do this well, but I think nonfiction writing, when it talks about, you know, these kinds of relationships that people have with nature, they really excel through whether the memoir format or, you know, what Simon Montgomery does. It's one of those things where I think nonfiction really sort of does it because they're talking about real relationships and there's no need to apply any imagination or fictionalized imagination. So
absolutely. I mean, when creative nonfiction writers come into my class, they're awed by the idea that in creative nonfiction, we're striving to understand something. And it often comes through on the page with these nonfiction pieces, this striving to understand whether it's nature, ourselves, the world in which we live. And that's usually a common thing.
Yeah. Oh, look, we've got more tweets coming in. See, we've got a very literate audience here. So Kristen Caffrey, and Kristen, I hope I said your last name right. She sent us a tweet that says she likes The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat by, of course, the great Oliver Sacks.
Oh, yeah.
Amy Holden Jones loves The Apprentice by Jacques Pepin. It's an autobiography of a brilliant life spanning food revolutions and two centuries and continents. Great, so some food writing there. We got a tweet from Alex Ashlock. Maybe I shouldn't be reading this because he's actually a WBUR employee. He works at Here and Now. But Alex says, my favorite so far is Frank Shorter's My Marathon, an Olympic champion's memoir. That will surprise you. Got a couple others. Kevin Brunil says, Pagan Kennedy's Inventology. Great read about invention and creativity. And Amy Holden Jones sends us another one. The Tomcat, great beach read, and she wrote it. Okay. Good plug there, Amy. Send us your tweet at Radio Boston for your favorite summer nonfiction reads. That's what we're talking about with Suchi Saraswat. She's the book buyer at Brookline Booksmith, and Isan Kim, Youth Programs Fellow and Creative Writing Instructor at Grub Street in Boston. Now, I don't want to leave the nature theme just yet, because you guys do have some great suggestions on your summer nonfiction list about books that talk about different ways to explore our world. Isan, you've got one called Lonely City.
Oh, so Lonely City does a beautiful job. Olivia Lang does a beautiful job of talking about how loneliness is just a part of the human condition. And sometimes it's not something to be avoided. It's something to be embraced. And she talks about it through the filter of art, Andy Warhol and other amazing artists and filmmakers, and how they channeled loneliness, particularly loneliness within very large cities, and used it as inspiration and the fuel behind their art. And so it was really, really well done. I think a book just about loneliness would have been a little bit maybe unbearable for some, but it's so artfully done that I think she does a fabulous job.
Yeah, I mean, there's the idea of loneliness loneliness or solitude, or the inspiration, different kinds of inspiration that either of those experiences can provide. Suchi, I love this one. It's on your list, A Field Guide to Getting Lost.
Yes, this is one of my all-time favorites. So this is by Rebecca Solnit, who a lot of people know now because of her book Men Explain Things to Me. But this is one of her first, or one of her earlier books, I should say. She's written quite a few books. And she's just one of those people who can write about so many different subjects. In this particular book, she takes the idea of getting lost and explores it through nature, explorers, film, art. And they're all these kind of you know, stories that she touches upon. In between them, she's got this these essays called The Blue of Distance. And they all take the idea of longing and kind of, you know, an example of it is mountains that are set off in the distance. They're always blue. And the more you walk towards them, they kind of continue to stay blue. They will always kind of be blue, and you can never really reach it. And so this is, you know, these explorers are all trying to reach something that they can never quite grasp. And so she just kind of plays around with that very, you know, nebulous idea and really kind of attaches these great stories to it. She's exceptional.
Well, we've got a couple more suggestions coming in. Elaine Almquist sent us a tweet saying, I still love Brenda Maddox's biography, Rosalind Franklin, the Dark Lady of DNA. Nancy Gold sent us a tweet saying, anything by Mary Roach. Hilarious and informative. Again, send us a tweet at Radio Boston about your favorite summer nonfiction reads. Let's shift gears here entirely, because we've been spending some time talking about nature and exploration. Let's talk about matters of the heart, because there's some really good nonfiction out there about this. And I want to play some tape to introduce one of your suggestions here. This is Aziz Ansari. We've got a clip of him talking about the agony of modern dating at one of his major stand-up gigs live at Madison Square Garden.
You send the first text, you're all confidence. Forget about it. It's done. 20 minutes later, no response. Okay, well, I'm sure she's just busy with a couple of things, and any minute now, 3 hours later, I put too many exclamation points in my text! What was I thinking? I should have said, hey, with 2 Ys, not 3 Ys. I'm so stupid!
That's Aziz Ansari. And Shuchi, his book, Modern Romance, major list.
Yeah, you know, this book is so funny because He's a comedian, and he's taking this idea of romance. But he paired up with a sociologist for this book. So there are a lot of studies through this where they're, you know, they're kind of talking to couples, and they're including statistics. There's graphs. He's got a bunch of photos of people's online dating profiles and kind of examines how these photos, you know, takes the patterns of these photos and kind of figures out what the ideal photo would be for a dating profile. So it's, you know, it's funny, but there is research in there too. So you're actually kind of learning something while reading this this really kind of quirky book.
Yeah, it sounds good. And to have his voice and his style be the thing that carries you through it, I think is one of the things that makes it such a great read. Now, Isan, you've got a different kind of love nonfiction here, A Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating by Moira Weigel.
Indeed. It's funny because Sushi just talked about learning a little something as you read a book, and this really happens. You get the history of dating and what dating was like many, many years ago, and all the way to the present with internet and online dating and how people date today. And what's interesting about this book is that it gets you to reconsider this circus that dating is, and it reminds you to say that who is it serving? In many ways, it just seems to train women to want to be wanted. But really, what do you want out of love beyond that? And I love a lot of nonfiction that just gets us to look at things we accept and take for granted and step back and go, what are we really doing here? And I think this book does that really, really well.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Well, we've got a couple minutes to go. And gosh, your lists are so good. We're not even going to get to half of them. And I should let people know that we've got the complete list at our website, radioboston.org. And you should definitely take time to check it out. You could pick any one of these books and you'd have a delightful read for the rest of the summer. But very briefly, can we just touch upon your memoir picks? Because Shuchi, you've got I'm Just a Person from Tig Notaro.
Yeah. So Tig Notaro is a stand-up comedian. And in 2012, she was, you know, kind of going through this really brutal year. She just got cancer. She's going through a breakup, the death of her mother. And she kind of just goes up on stage and says, you know, I'm going to talk about this horrible time I'm having. She was very honest.
It's a routine that made her career.
Yeah, it did. And so this is the memoir of that year. And I think there's something, you know, she's blunt, but she's funny, and knowing now she's married and she's in remission, it kind of has a happy ending. I think there's something kind of nice knowing that there's hope at the end of what her really bad year. I think it's also got some nice illustrations, and it's a really interesting book.
And Isan, we just got a couple seconds. Your pick for a memoir
is Pour Your Soul by Mira Pitassin, and it really shows that while we all walk grief alone, when we come out the other side, we find that the people who love us were never that far away.
Yeah. Well, look, we've got some more suggestions coming in. All our readers listening. Benita Catastrophes talking about reading Between the World and Me, of course, by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Liz T. says Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson. Let's see. Gerard Mark or Marquez. I'm sorry if I said your name wrong, Gerard. Favorite nonfiction is The Witches Salem, 1692 by Stacey Schiff. So just the start of some of the suggestions from our listeners. Keep them coming at Radio Boston. And if you want to see Shuchi's and Eason's list, go to radioboston.org, and we've got those lists there. Shuchi Saraswat, book buyer at Brookline Booksmith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Eason Kim, youth programs fellow and creative writing instructor at Grub Street in Boston, thank you as well.
Thank you.
I don't even know where I'm going to start now with all these books to read in the next couple of weeks, but I will definitely try to pick up one for this weekend, because it is Friday afternoon. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a great and safe weekend, and join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.